You are listening to Secret Handshake, the podcast covering the movies that help you identify your friends and maybe make a few more along the way. Coming up, Spine number 74, Den of Thieves, and Gerard Butler's Fallen trilogy. Featuring headstabs, racisms, stacked casts, multiple massacres, Korean terrorists, Middle Eastern terrorists, American terrorists, rocket launchers, bloody donuts, 50 Cent, multiple Heat references, European pixie dust, and Nick Nolte. Martin.
Yes.
Let's play a game of fuck off. You go first. Welcome back to another edition of Secret Handshake. I'm your host, Jacob Knight, and joining me as always is Martin Carlson. Martin, I've converted you. You are a Butler boy now.
I've come around. Took me a while.
But we're doing, as our first episode of 2025, Den of Thieves, the great dirtbag Redbox Heat knockoff from, it would be like 2018, I want to say. And then it's sequel, Den of Thieves 2, Pantera, has just released in the theaters. It was the number one movie in the box office over the weekend.
It beat Better Man.
It beat Better Man by a lot. Better Man, a movie you quite like.
I love Better Man.
I still haven't gotten around to it, but now everybody's become so enthusiastic for it that I'm like, okay, I guess I got to watch this thing now. I got to watch this chimpanzee sing these Robbie Williams songs.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan. It made $1 million over the weekend, though.
Total. American?
Yeah.
Or in pounds? Or Canadian?
Yeah.
Rupees?
Yep.
But we're not here to talk about Better Man or Robbie Williams. We're here to talk about Gerard Butler, our beefy savior, who plays Big Nick O'Brien in the Den of Thieves films. But I think we should go back in time a little bit because, you know, I guess our first exposure to him would be 300. Is that like our major introduction to Gerard Butler?
For me, it was Dracula 2000, where he plays Dracula.
Okay.
That was the one where I was like, this guy. And
I don't think I noticed him in the movie, though. Like, I don't think he ever stood out to me.
Do you know where he stood out the most? No joke. Was Reign of Fire. He's best friends with Christian Bale.
Oh, yeah. And he's really good.
And he's got his Scottish accent. He's very charming. And you're like, he's the second banana.
Yeah, I guess that would be my introduction. But again, that wasn't the one where he was like front and center, the star of the movie.
Right.
Like King Leonidas is.
I mean, 300's huge.
You know, and it does become like a massive hit and basically launches his career as like a leading man. But yeah, Reign of Fire, he is quite good in. And then he has the Fallen movies, which are kind of like, for me, the bridge between 300 and what Big Nick O'Brien becomes in the Den of Thieves films is kind of like his signature role, like Mike Banning, Secret Service agent, and Jason Voorhees, head stabber to President Morgan Freeman. Well, really, President Aaron Eckhart first, and then President Morgan Freeman. Like that's the role for me that kind of acts as like the bridge between the two, because there's way more Big Nick in Mike Banning than there is in like King Leonidas. Although there's another movie that we'll talk about here down the line that comes earlier on. I believe it's 2009, which is Law Abiding Citizen from F. Gary Gray, which is the one that I really think kind of sets him off down this path of being like this gruff, tough DTV kind of like action hero, even though in that movie he's the bad guy. He's almost like Gerard Butler as Jigsaw in that.
I thought he's Gerard Butler as Jigsaw, honestly, mixed with a Hannibal Lecter in a way, because the idea of like...
The abominable Dr. Phoebes.
The idea of being stuck.
Yeah.
You're locked up. How can he control all these horrible things? Or Dr. Mabuse, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he's in the Stell. How could he possibly... be blowing up cars, and the reveal of how he's doing it is funny.
Preposterous is the word you're searching for.
So ridiculous. It has the kind of subtlety of a movie like Swordfish,
yeah,
where it's like it's about misdirection. I'm like, yeah, this is not.
Well, you pointed out off mic that it came from the pen of one of the premier kind of trash meisters of the 2000s, which was Kurt Wimmer.
Director and writer of Equilibrium.
A movie that I sought out in the theaters and went to see.
I saw it 4 times in 1 week.
I saw it multiple times
myself. I loved that when it came out.
The movie's super fun. I don't know if I would revisit it now and vouch for it, but at the time, quite liked it.
It was like, hey, what if I just did Fahrenheit 451 with The Matrix?
With Gunkata.
With Gunkata and a little bit of Brave New World.
Well, and it's also during the time when, like, Christian Bale was still, like, a sort of unknown commodity. Like, we really only knew him as, like, Patrick Bateman at that point.
It's months after Reign of Fire.
Yeah, exactly.
Which also was not a huge... It did fine, but it wasn't, like, it didn't cement him
star. Well, and they're trying to elevate Christian Bale at that point. Like, that's when they're really trying to convert him. And that's even before, like, super actorly Christian Bale.
Yeah.
There's some stories that came off the set of, like, American Psycho about, like, his method acting.
Well, Machinist is 2004.
Machinist 2 is another big one. But, like, Reign of Fire and Equilibrium and stuff like that were, like, the movies where they were like, what if this guy was also, like, an action hero? And we're kind of like, yeah, sure, I guess.
We get McConaughey in that as well. They're also trying to figure
him out. McConaughey's so fucking good in Reign of Fire.
He's like Quint, but sexy.
Yeah,
like, it's
shaved head. And he's full on doing, because that's pre-McConaissance, where he's really doing like the all right, all right, all right, Texas boy kind of macho thing. But it's like, that feels like when we were talking about bridge movies, like sort of like the bridge between like the How to Lose Your Guy in 10 Days and then like what we would get in like, Rust Cole and True Detective and those things. But like with Gerard Butler and Law Abiding Citizen, one of the most amazing things about that is that like he's playing the hero. Like he kind of, if you watch that movie through a certain lens, he is the hero of the movie because he's more or less John Kramer. He's a guy whose wife is raped and murdered and his child is executed by two home invaders who are more or less like not let off because one pleads against the other to put him on death row.
Yep.
The wrong one does. Basically, the wrong one is given the deal by Jamie Foxx, who's like the district attorney of Philadelphia. It's a pretty good fucking Philadelphia movie.
It's great.
If I do say so myself. But then, 10 years later go by. The one guy gets put on death row. The other guy does like 3 years or something for more or less like manslaughter for his plea deal. And Gerard Butler loses everything, sells all of his property and stuff. And we find out later that he's a secret, like, rich guy for some pretty nefarious, crazy reasons.
Well, he was a contractor.
A defense contractor.
But was, like, the best at, like, he was a thinker.
He was a think tank type.
Yeah.
That's what he's described as.
Yeah.
And if he wants you dead, you would be dead. But he basically goes out and takes revenge. He goes full Paul Kersey. It's almost like if you crossed Paul Kersey with John Kramer from the Saw movies.
Yeah.
Is that like he gets his death wish moment where he's going out against this system that did him dirty and let his wife's, rapist and murderer and his child's murderer off easy. And he like infiltrates death row and like executes a guy in like the most heinous way possible and then proceeds to kill everyone who was involved in the trial and let them off early.
He cuts a guy's penis off. With a box cutter.
He cuts a man's penis off with a box cutter and then dismembers him into, I think they say, 26 pieces?
Yeah.
In like the most Saw-esque scene
in
the movie. And then it becomes like a guy who gets himself put in prison, but he's only there because he wants to be there.
Well, he's very Joker in that way, too.
Exactly.
You know, like Heath
and
Ledger's
he's
Joker.
Manipulating yeah. everything from inside of this jail cell. But, man, it was like, this really was a we used to make shit in this country type movie because yeah. it's like a mid-level programmer with a fucking stacked cast. You know, you have Jamie Foxx, Gerard Butler, the mayor of Philadelphia is played by
Viola Davis.
Viola Davis, like before, right when she's on the cusp of being in stuff like The Help and yep. everything.
Where her career exploded.
Yeah, Leslie Bibb is in
Bruce
it. Bruce McGill, like, and when the violence fucking pops off in this movie, it's like severely violent and bloody and gory. Like that whole sequence where he turns like a bomb removal robot into like a turret gun death machine is so fucking awesome.
He literally shoots tank rounds at Bruce McGill's Suburban when they're driving through this fucking cemetery. You're like, it's what? Well, it's so bananas because I had a little personal anecdote with this film. When I was at Emory, they brought F. Gary Gray to talk about the making of Law Abiding Citizen to our film class.
Well, that's the thing is we haven't even mentioned F. Gary Gray's name yet. It's like, here's the director of fucking Friday, and then he would eventually go and make Straight Outta Compton, and then would make, like, is it Fast 8?
Fast 8, but yeah, Set It
Fate
Off.
Fate of the Furious, I want to say. He made Set It Off.
Great movie.
A Man Apart,
yep.
which, like, he, before he started making Fast and Furious movies and stuff. This was kind of like his bread and butter. Like he made
yeah.
these mid-tier
Italian job.
Counter-programming kind of like, you know, January, February, March releases that were just like $30, $40 million movies, had awesome casts, and then just delivered exactly what you fucking wanted. But Law Abiding Citizen, I think, is kind of a cut above because like this movie's bananas.
Well, it's also aged particularly well.
Oh,
and
yeah.
By that, what you're saying is like, you know, we used to make things like, it was the same experience you and I had with American Gangster for
right.
me, where I was like, how is there anything wrong with this movie at all? Like, because we were going in, I went in with that movie with higher expectations, and I'm like, the bar has been lowered so much for what Hollywood puts out. Like, this is just a fucking balm to that.
Yeah, if you release this, like, this would probably be, if we put this out now, this would probably be a Netflix movie.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Like, it would be like a Jomie Collett Sarah type, like what he just did with Carry On.
Yep.
To where it would just make its way to Netflix or one of the streamers. It would play, like, a bunch of us would talk about it for a weekend, and then it would disappear. Like, this movie did pretty well at the box office. And it also, like, it comes out the same year as Gaver, the Neville Dean and Taylor movie that
yeah.
Gerard Butler also starred in. And, like, this was kind of, like, the announcement of, like, this guy, he's not just going to be King Leonidas, and he's not going to be the rom-com dude that they're trying to put him in like, The Bounty Hunter with, like, Katherine Heigl. Like, there was, or, like, P.S. I Love You was the other one that he's in, and that's, like, I think that's Hilary Swank was in that movie.
I think, yeah.
If I recall correctly.
Where he has the daughter, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's, like, it was a great example of almost like a Sam Worthington style story. And you brought this up when we were at the bar the other night before we went to see Den of Thieves 2, is that it was almost like, okay, here's this guy. He's super jacked. He's Scottish. He's like really handsome and almost like a Sean Connery-ish type way. Like
yeah.
he's got that rogue kind of charm to him, but we don't quite know what to do with him yet.
Yeah.
Is he a leading man? Is he a rom-com leading man? Is he an action dude? But then, like, Gamer and Law Abiding Citizen show us that, like, he's got this other thing to where, like, he could be a B-movie guy, and he could be the best at it, and that became, like, what his career was, is that he starts making almost, like, these elevated versions of, like, these B-movies, and that they're all centered around him, and he really, like, when you let Gerard Butler go fucking ham, it's the most fun ever. Like, Law Abiding Citizen, like, that whole scene in the courtroom where he more or less, like, argues his way out of being, you know, denied bail against Jamie Foxx, and the judge is about to do it, and then he's like, Are you fucking serious?
You're gonna let me go?
Goes out on it and like literally goes ham on the judge and ends it with, and I bet you take it up the ass too, lady. And you're like, what the fuck, dude? Like, he always, that's the other thing about him that I love. And it also is like what would lead to Mike Banning and Big Nick O'Brien is that there's almost like a streak in him that's uncouth or like rough edges of like, you could see him saying some very upsetting, like blue humor to somebody, but it just kind of fits the character because he's not offended by it. And he almost like leans into it a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you're obviously the Scottish comparison for Sean Connery of Connor, who we know was known for being quite prickly,
right?
Off screen.
By all accounts, Gerard Butler is not, though, is that he's apparently like the nicest guy ever.
But I think that's what's interesting is he's putting that into his on-screen character.
Yeah.
Of like, he's bringing this rough, like, this is the guy you meet down at the pub.
Exactly.
You give him a couple too many drinks and he says some blue humor, like you said.
Or maybe Tom Hardy type.
Well, I mean, even a little bit of Statham, all these kind of like soccer hooligan kind of guys.
Yeah.
Right. You believe they're brawlers. And they all kind of have busted up faces, especially he and Hardy.
Yeah, they've all been in a fight or two.
And it looks like it's for real. But I think you're totally right is that when he's trying to be sweet and cute is why I don't think it really works.
No.
Well,
sometimes. I have a counter to that, but you keep going.
But I think a lot of times, so as you said at the beginning of the podcast, like you converted me, I used to hate Gerard Butler. And I'm
so glad I got you on this trade.
The number one.
Jerry Boys for life.
The number one sin for me was Phantom of the Opera, where.
I like that movie.
He's so miscast.
I don't know.
Also, the Phantom, you know, a very hard part to play, and you hire it, and pretty much, I mean, there was that era, too, of, like, we're not even trying to get real singers in here.
No.
Like, you know,
That movie looks great,
though.
Oh,
dude, it's one of Schumacher's
best-looking films.
Well, the whole ending, everything in the catacombs under the, like, in, like, the cisterns and stuff's amazing. I just, like, as a big musical theater nerd, I was like, fuck this guy. And then...
Damn.
I held that against him for years.
That's fucked up.
And then...
You're going to do Jerry like that.
And I think what really put me off on him was when he was trying to be cute and approachable, kind of more like a general star, where he'd be like, oh, I'm just the good dad, right? And I never really bought into it. And then the more that I've seen his stuff where he's more to the side of Big Nick, I'm on board.
See, but when he combines that stuff, though, too, I think that's kind of like, where his signature roles really come from. Like Mike Banning, especially with the early stuff with Aaron Eckhart's son and everything,
yeah.
Is that like he gets to do a little bit of both. Like, you know, Olympus Has Fallen, the first in the Fallen trilogy, you know, like there's that whole section of the movie that's devoted to his relationship with the kid,
yep.
And also saving the kid after the terrorist attack goes down and the White House is basically blown up. Like his first mission in the very video game kind of style plotting that dominates that film is like rescue the president's son and get him out.
Yeah, fetch quest stuff. We got to do this, then we got to do this.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then it becomes kill everybody in the most graphic way possible. But that movie, I think that's why Mike Banning, before Big Nick O'Brien, is his signature role. It still might be his signature role, even though I like the Den of Thieves movies more, is because like he gets to do everything in those three movies. And granted, he gets the runway to do everything is that most people don't get to play the same character for three separate films.
Yeah.
So like you get a little bit of everything. And like, as you watch these movies, cause I believe you had never seen
London
or Angel.
No.
So you got to see all three of them. And like, you know, Mike Banning, as he's presented in Olympus Has Fallen, is like very much a John McClane kind of knockoff. Like,
yeah.
I mean, it is Antoine Fuqua just basically doing Die Hard with the White House.
That's it. That's the pitch.
A more psychotic version of Die Hard. I mean, it's more in like the Cannon Films Invasion USA kind of mold where like you almost expect, if he wasn't dead, obviously, for Richard Lynch to pop up at some point. But like...
Or like a Triple X movie. It felt like that level.
That level, but like just really mean-spirited.
Yeah.
Like they kill... so many innocent people in Olympus Has Fallen. That opening massacre sequence where the turret guns come out of the fucking North Korean kind of cargo plane and are just mowing tourists and pedestrians down, like, absolutely psychotic bullshit. Then they blow up the fucking Washington Monument.
Well, they hit it and it falls over.
That movie is crazy. And it falls on people.
It's
like, it literally crushes people to death. This movie is tremendous.
Well, and it's another film. Can I go back, take you back in time
for
a moment and hope you're still my friend by the end?
Well, you've matured.
I have.
You've come to love Big Nick and Mike Banning.
Okay, so I had a film, I had my own blog called US 31 Film Reviews.
What did that stand for?
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, the base from Antarctica, from the thing.
Oh,
but it's also the street, it's also the road I grew up on in Indiana, US 31. So it's a double.
Ooh.
But this is the first, my
a
first
dual meaning, as it were.
My first review on the site was for Olympus Has Fallen.
Get the fuck out of
here.
That was
the first thing I did.
Your inaugural blog post.
Okay, so this is Wednesday, March 27th, 2013. Mm-hmm. So I was 29 years old.
I was married.
You were married.
I was still living. Oh, no, I had just moved to Austin.
Okay, here we go. Gerard Butler, where did you come from and what do we do to deserve you? You're like some old tenured professor. You're taking up your position and depriving us of a younger, more talented action star.
How dare you?
You have to have a discussion with your dialogue coach. Your American accent is laughable. Hey, did Arnold ever cover up his accent? No. Did Sean Connery ever win an Oscar playing an Irish cop with a Scottish accent? Yep. Just own it, man. Also, don't do musicals. Your rendition of Music of the Night made my loins hurt. That was just the first paragraph.
Damn. You went hard on Jerry.
It gets meaner from there. But I will say I'm sorry, Gerard. I was,
you were young and impressionable.
Yeah. And I really didn't like it the first time, but I came, honestly, knowing where his career went and being able to put this in its place,
sure,
it makes it make more sense to me. And like, knowing that this is in no way trying to be anything but, like you said, like a McClane ripoff, it's meaner, it's Canon Films. It's also, we got to mention, it's a Millennium film.
Yeah.
And so Millennium Films, who we were kind of talking off mic about being the kind of inheritor of the mantle,
the Canon
of Canon
Films mantle,
just that complete schlock, just
really
knowing,
mean-spirited action movies.
Yep, but just like, hey, just having no trouble with just being, being broad and general, and maybe a little hacky in their
own
way.
They're junk programmers.
Yeah,
that's,
I mean,
what they did.
The Expendables are like their biggest series
franchise.
So there you go. But I really like this one, and I think it's to your point though about how he mixes in a little bit of that, like, playing the dad, playing, like, the helpful adult.
Yeah.
Like, the movie, and I don't want to jump ahead, but, like, I watched Greenland in prep for this pod, and that movie blew me completely away. Rick Roman was a filmmaker, but also Butler's so good in it. Like, he's kind of doing his version of, like, Joel from The Last of Us. As this, it's basically a zombie film without zombies.
Yeah, 100%.
But he's not a soldier, he's just a dad. But you have this, he has this, like, the opening scenes of him, his son has diabetes, and you have these, like, kind of nice scenes of he's going through a divorce with the mom, or they think they're on the rocks, and he comes in, and for some reason, I think maybe with his age, he's aged into me buying that more. Like, I buy his softness more.
Well, as he gets craggier,
yeah,
he actually, you buy his world weariness.
Yes.
And he has some of the best divorced dad energy in the history of cinema.
Yeah, and all of them, basically all the films, to some extent. Yeah.
Well, that's what I mean. Like, he's always, not always, but like he's playing a lot of guys who are either on the rocks with their partner or separated or just, in Big Nick's case, fully divorced and fleeing the country. So, like, he's great at it, but like, as he's gotten older, it's, again, the Connery comparison to where he's the type of dude that they just don't really make anymore.
Yeah.
Like, we always talk about, when we talk about guys like Lee Marvin,
Bronson,
Sean Connery, Oliver Reed, like these old school guys who just lived hard and like the years were on their face, but they still remained incredibly handsome. Like that's Gerard Butler. And as he's gotten older, the age and like the crow's feet around his eyes and like the weight that he puts on for like the Den of Thieves movies and the way he kind of handles himself as this big leathery
tank
brawler of a human being.
Yeah.
Like, it makes him more attractive, and you actually buy his energy on screen more than you do when he's even like King Leonidas. Like, that feels manufactured. Now, granted, that's a Zack Snyder movie, so like all of his movies feel artificial to
everyone's
one degree
perfect
or another.
Looking and,
exactly. Yeah. Like, but like, as he's gotten older and he's gotten craggier and stuff, like, you buy him more as a human being.
No, you're right. And I think there is something that comes. All the stars you're mentioning, too, is like they aged into something. Like
right.
Most of Bronson's success was when he's older. Lee Marvin, a lot of the roles I think of, besides his early kind of Western side characters.
Well, Bronson's not, once we finally do our Bronson episode, it's one of the things we'll actually go into is that, like, you know, when he's doing the canon era, like he's in his 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
You know, and he looks like he's in his 50s and 60s. And like he lived an entire life, you know, mining coal, like that's where he got his body in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
You know, and he's like so jacked, but he's jacked in a way that like isn't like gym jacked. Like he's jacked in like I did fucking manual labor and like my lungs are probably fucked up and my face is like weathered and like I'm 28 but I look 53. You know,
yeah, you
but
that.
Then he just was eternally 53 for like his whole acting career, because he doesn't even really get into acting with like Alain Delon and stuff when he does the movies in France until like his 40s.
Well, he's kind of that scene of him in Magnificent Seven, like his introduction where he's just like he's literally chopping wood and he's cut from wood. You're like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Like younger Bronson. But that also
there was no young Bronson. Bronson was born in his 30s.
Yeah, he's born old. actually, it makes me think about Butler, too, is, you know, I was in my review there, I was making fun of his accent, and he has a very unique American accent. But
he talks out of the side of his mouth a lot.
I think it actually, now, I love it because it's him. You know what I mean? It's like Bronson. Bronson has that weird, unplaceable mixture of him trying to be American.
Do you believe in Jesus? Well, you're about to meet him.
It's for jerking off. You know, but with Butler too is like,
I remember we had when we were watching a bunch of those movies in a row not too long ago. We even looked at each other and we're like, if you didn't know like anything about Bronson, where would you try to place him? Like, where the fuck would he be from?
No, seriously. And he has that. But it's what makes it kind of with Butler, too, is because he's been so consistent with his output and like he just does his thing now with that voice. It really works for him. Now it's like I consider him now a B movie star.
Oh, yeah. Versus well, he's judging, the king of the B movie.
I'm
now.
Judging him as a B movie star, not an actor, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
I
think that's also what elevates his movies a lot more, especially as they go along, and especially the Den of Thieves movies, which I think
are
B movies technically, but like Den of Thieves 2, which we'll get into here at length, like that's better than like most A-list films that you get to see.
Oh, 100%, especially in the action genre.
Oh my God, it's incredible.
Yeah.
But I think also Butler, as he's matured, one of the other guys he reminds me of too is Bruce Willis.
Yes.
He's moved on, like to your point, Bruce Willis, like he found the thing that worked for him, which was that kind of, again, squinty, Bronson-esque whisper speakers. Hey, man. Come down to the coast, have a few laughs. But that became Bruce Willis as he went along. Now, he would deviate from that a little bit in, like, some of the stranger stuff that he was in, like Death Becomes Her and everything.
Yeah, or Bonfire of the Vanities.
Yeah, exactly. But when you signed up for like a Die Hard movie, you knew what Bruce Willis you were getting. Even with like The Fifth Element, you knew what Bruce Willis you were getting. And that's kind of what Gerard Butler is now too, is that like he found his thing, that gruff, I talk out of the side of my mouth, you get a little bit of the brogue in there because I can't really hold it back all the way.
Yeah.
But like it actually adds an accent to it that's pretty fucking cool.
Yeah.
Especially with Big Nick as it goes along. Like when he comes to that first crime scene, he's like, what do you got for me, boys? And he's picking up a fucking donut off of the a crime scene.
Yeah.
And like eating it and like looks like he hasn't slept in like 3 days and he's all puffy from alcohol and cocaine. But like that little bit of Scottish brogue that's kind of worked into his dialect and that he's not even fighting against anymore, it adds a bit of character to him because you're just like, yeah, this is just fucking Big Nick. This is what Gerard Butler does, man.
Yep, and he, there's something beyond him as an actor I think that is makes him special is he produces a majority of the films that he's in now.
Yeah.
And I've read a lot of...
And he's found his guys.
Well... Christian Gudegast and then Rick Roman Waugh, right, are both amazing action directors. They really, really are. No one has made him look cooler.
Yeah.
Like, he looks cooler in this than he did. 300 is all artificial and it's fine. But, like, he's so badass in these movies.
Well, and again, to bring up Bronson again, which I never had really thought about until we started getting into this kind of this comparison is that, yeah, Bronson would have like four dudes that he worked with all the time with like J. Lee Thompson types who, because he just knew like they got what a Charles Bronson movie was. They got what made Charles Bronson look cool on screen when he entered those scenes. And they also got what Charles Bronson's limitations were as an actor and also what his strengths are. And I think that's what Butler does too, is that he's found these collaborators who are just like, I know what Gerard Butler can do and I know what he can't do. And this is how he's going to look great.
Well, and there's this, so it reminds me of this article I read, and it was about The Rock, and they were saying what The Rock has needed is a good director collaborator.
Right.
And he hasn't had one. They were saying the reason you're not Arnold Schwarzenegger, you had the ability to become, is you never had a James Cameron. You never had someone to elevate you out of that.
Well, and he's kind of shied away from these types because he actually was in a Rick Roman Waugh movie.
Yeah.
Because he's in Snitch. But yes. Then he never really goes back to him again.
Yeah, he goes on that he's really in this like kid friendly, you know, Welcome to the Jumanji stuff. And now that's Red One, I guess, which is abysmal. But with Butler, it's funny, is that what I like about Den of Thieves and what I think Angel in the series of the Fallen series is there is some CG, but out of the three, it's the least because it has more of the more ground level besides the amazing drone scene,
which is fucking awesome.
It's amazing.
It doesn't matter.
But a lot of it's like really like real explosions, real stunts.
Dude, that sequence, I know we're jumping ahead a little bit, but yeah, the sequence where he finds Nick Nolte, who, that's the other thing that Angel Has Fallen has, is Nick Nolte is cast as fucking Gerard Butler's dad, and there's a huge segment of that movie. Basically, the whole second half of Angel Has Fallen is almost like a buddy movie between Mike Banning and his dad, who's played by Nick Nolte. So it just becomes these two gruff dudes growling at each other.
Yeah.
Butler's like, what the fuck are you doing, dad? And then Nolte's like, shut the fuck up. I'm gonna fucking shut some light.
I run away. I said you and your wife and your family.
But he's like, that whole sequence in the woods when you first get to, because I guess to set it up, Mike Banning, you know, in Olympus Has Fallen, is a Secret Service agent. He's one of the head Secret Service agents, basically Aaron Eckhart's like most trusted guy. In London Has Fallen is very much like the Die Hard 2 of the series, is that it's just like, okay, what if we did the first movie, but we did it in a different locale? Or like in the Die Hard films, you have the L.A. versus East Coast kind of dichotomy of Die Hard 1 and Die Hard 2.
And the weather.
The snow, exactly. Yeah. But, I mean, this kind of does the same thing, is that they're like, okay, well, we blew up D.C. in the last film. what city would be cool to blow up in the second one that feels kind of different structurally? What if we blew up London? And, like, that's the movie. You know, but Banning's just a Secret Service agent in that, to where an angel has fallen. He's even offered, like, the director of the Secret Service position. And, like, Angel, like, my... I know we disagree on this, and we can get into it right now, is that the big difference between Angel and the other two movies is that Angel treats Mike Banning as a human being, where in the first two films, he's basically Jason Voorhees, but as a Secret Service agent who just loves torturing, killing, and fucking shooting the shit out of terrorists. Like, he, and spitting one-liners, and, like, he's inhuman, and he's also unkillable. Wherein Angel Has Fallen, Angel Has Fallen is almost like the Skyfall of the Mike Banning series, to where, like, they're trying to diagnose, like, what makes Mike Banning tick. Like, what is his trauma? What is his like, how is he breaking down as a human being? Like, to where when you get to Skyfall and Spectre and stuff in the Daniel Craig Bond series, you watch this blunt instrument, as they refer to him in those films, like, start to break down, start to lose his edge, start to show his age. Angel Has Fallen is that. It's like, what if Mike Banning, but he's actually destructible now? And it's like, I don't know how much I want that, but it's still a pretty good fucking movie, and it allows Gerard Butler to actually show you a little bit more of his acting chops, so it's also kind of hard to complain about.
Yeah, and for me, like, I don't have as much time put into, like, loving this series. So for me, I watched one and two, and I'm like, wow, this is super fun. Like, I like the gore. I like that it's really mean.
Three is a real movie.
But yeah, and that's, I think that's what I, for me, it was the, it was two things. It was the level of the action I thought was a huge even step up. Not in, so, like, you get less hand-to-hand stuff that you get from the other two.
It's different.
It's different. But for me, like, the explosion stuff, so there's this drone strike early on, which is just, like, these concussive, amazing sound. I had it turned up with my subwoofer.
They're also, like, kamikaze bird drones?
Yeah, it's fucking cool. And it's,
they,
like,
attack in flocks? They're fucking awesome.
Yeah, it's so, like, it's so cheeseball, but it's cool as hell.
And it's all set on, is it the lake at Camp David?
No,
it's in Pennsylvania, because they're on a boat in Pennsylvania, because I noticed all the Pennsylvania plates on the cars. And but then they go to West Virginia to find
his dad.
But
you have, like, it, to your point, it actually tries to do something with the idea of what happens to soldiers after they come back from war. And you have his dad, who was ruined by the Vietnam War, and that's why he left the family and went into hiding, because he's like, I was dangerous. And then, but then you have the villain of the film, Danny Houston, who's this, like, Blackwater contractor guy who was in battle with Mike back in the day.
Profiteering.
But for him, it's kind of like, well, I need this contract. Like, we're lions. Like, we can't turn this off. Like, we come back, how do we go back to normal life?
And also, like, yeah, how, not if you go back, like, in Nick Nolte's case, he can't go back to normal life. He comes back and he becomes, like, almost like the cliched, like, can't deal with my wife and kids, and basically moves off the grid.
Yeah, Unabomber style,
To where Banning finds a way to basically channel that fury into just being, like, the murder robot Secret Service agent.
Yeah.
And then Danny Houston represents, like, well, how do you make a living off of killing people?
Yeah.
And he becomes a Blackwater-style kind of profiteer, to where he's running, they're almost like training camps for soldiers.
Yeah, because, well, the idea, one of the main plot threads of the movie is that the president, the current president, Morgan Freeman, is against the use of private military groups.
Right.
And they are trying, in Danny Houston, so now, because he can't use his men in battle, he's like, well, I guess we'll just do training camps for, like, soldiers and for, you know, law enforcement agencies. But his idea is, well, I'll make a lot more money if we can get back in the battlefield. So, like, we need to get involved and get rid of the president. But, I think the use of, like, ridiculous explosive action, and also there's a couple other scenes, too, like the incursion on the hospital at the end is absolutely amazing. Danny Houston does his normal bad guy thing, and he's good at it.
Yeah, as soon as he shows up, you're like, well, there's the bad guy.
Well, yeah, he's like, oh, they were in the war together, and he like yeah, he
had we're my, lions.
That's the villain. But it's a really funny film coming after the reprehensible London Has Fallen. I mean, that
you say movie, reprehensible like that's a bad thing.
No, but it is a racist fucking movie.
Yes,
oh,
it is.
Oh my God.
And I know this sounds terrible, but I love every second of it. Not because I love racism, but because it's what makes it feel like a canon film.
Yeah.
Like it is, it's politically abhorrent.
Yeah.
Reactionary as hell. Advocates, it basically tells you drone strikes are good.
Yep.
Like, and the president is allowed to use them as long as you're killing bad people. It opens with a drone strike.
At a wedding.
And just because they're quote-unquote terrorists and arms dealers, it's okay to take them out. And also, like, Mike Banning gets to say some of the worst shit to anybody on screen. He tells somebody, what does he say? Go back to fuckheadistan or wherever you come from.
Go back to, and then he has the speech where he says, "You guys just don't get it.
You guys don't get it. We're not a flag. We're not one person.
Yeah, we're not.
We're not a building.
We're not a building.
You can bomb us. You can attack us, and in a million years, we'll still be here." And you're like, "Holy shit, dude!"
Yeah, it's wild.
Yeah. Well, also on top of being like graphically violent, like almost plotless, it's just basically like president goes to London, terrorist attack. Mike Banning has to get president from point A to point B in London. At some point, there's like British commandos who show up and you just kill everybody in your path. You want to talk about like video game plotting a lot like the first movie? It's just basically questing. It's questing. It's like, get the president from point A to point B, tell a couple homoerotic jokes, and then kill the bad guys with a drone strike, roll fucking credits. That's the other thing too, is that this movie clocks in at 95 minutes. The actual movie ends at like minute 87.
Yeah.
It's like, it's lean, mean, has a one-take machine gun battle that's like almost parody level of like, this is a DTV movie that somehow escaped red boxes and made its way into theaters.
Yeah, absolutely.
But like Angel Has Fallen, like because both of these movies, Olympus and London, did really well. Like they made a bunch of money. So like they made a third one and you can see that it's Butler and Rick Roman Waugh being like, oh shit, we got to make a third one. What if we made a real movie this time? And they do, and it's pretty fucking good.
Well, and then, so that's 2019, and then Greenland is 2020.
Right.
And that is, like, again, really where I could see them, you could see that, like, again, like you were saying earlier about, like, J. Lee Thompson knowing with Bronson, okay, what are the parameters? Like, what can he do?
Yeah.
And I think with Greenland, they really stretch it acting-wise. I think that he stretches more than he does.
He
in
gets
a lot
to emote a lot,
a lot more, and you really
and brood.
Like, but you buy the whole like it's like he gets separated from his family, and a lot of it's just this like series of like.
Well, you know what it is that you called it a zombie movie before. I think the closer comp is Spielberg's War of the Worlds.
That's the other one too.
Butler,
100%.
It's totally guy has to get his kids from point A to point B during the apocalypse and avoid getting murdered in the process. Where like every character in Greenland is Tim Robbins from War of the Worlds,
and it's really
grim.
There's a scene. Jacob brought over some cookies and cream, cookie dough Twix that I'm currently enjoying, and they're great.
It makes for great podcasting, just chewing into the microphone.
Just, yeah, but there's a scene with you have Hope Lang, and I forget the actor's name from the Office. But they are
it's not Steve Carell.
But they're a couple. And just for a little bit for plotting for the audience, like there is this. Basically, it's a meteor storm or an asteroid storm that's going to be hitting. And some people have been chosen to be able to go into these bunkers that's going to survive this this planet-killing blast. One giant meteor is going to be the last to hit and then wipe out 90% of Earth. But they've been chosen based on their you know need for the next civilization. So Gerard Butler's an engineer and he's an architect. They say, okay, you and your family can come. But they get these wristbands, which is completely like gold, you know, in this new like
pre-apocalyptic. It's like the golden ticket in Willy Wonka.
Well, seriously, it's like if you had that, you're gonna live, and your family's gonna live. So people are like, well,
I'm not joking.
Yeah,
that's
totally.
Basically what it is.
No, and so there's this, you know, a lot of scenes of like, oh, you have a wristband, I'm gonna fucking kill you for it. There's this really harrowing scene of
it's kind
of
like South by. Like peak South by 2017.
Yeah.
It's like you all the wristbands are sold out and you just walk downtown and you start murdering people so you can get into a movie premiere.
Yeah, exactly. That's how, you know.
It's exactly like that.
Well, you have, you know, they steal this kid, though. It's this really amazingly directed scene of like just this normal, like, married couple. They're not evil. They're just like, oh, we want to get in. So we're going to basically take this kid from his parents and hope we get in.
Use him as leverage.
And it's just a lot. It's like you said, it's a very Tim Robbins kind of like all these people have been driven a little bit mad by the situation. And you've got Gerard like really and Miranda Baccarin as the mother. It's great. It's absolutely great. And you can just see he and Rick Roman Waugh like really figuring each other out. And then I watched a lot of Kandahar as well. Also a really good movie. Yeah. I mean,
produced by Christian Gudegast.
Oh, there you go.
Who would write London Has Fallen, and then write and direct Den of Thieves, which I guess he was trying to get Den of Thieves made for like over 10 years.
Interesting.
Like while he was toying away as kind of like a script doctor and everything, and then, you know, worked his way up to actually having on-screen credits and everything, and then producer credits, and teams up with Gerard Butler to start making movies. And then he becomes one of Butler's guys because, you know, I guess they finally get into the movie that this episode's actually about, is that Den of Thieves is Butler's Heat. Like, even I, to take it back in time on my part, I remember calling it Redbox Heat when it first came out.
Very fair.
But, like, for me, that's not necessarily a diss. It's kind of a compliment. The reason I love Den of Thieves is that it both knows exactly what it is while having greater ambitions at the same time. It's like, why is this movie almost 150 minutes long? Like, no, like, action programmer at this budget and this caliber, like, should run that long. But it's because Christian Gudegast is like, well, I want to make my Heat. Like, that's what I'm doing. Like, I'm not hiding what my influences are, and I'm fine.
Right.
If you know that this is Heat right down to the actual running time, but like he also is smart enough to recognize that like if you're going to ape Michael Mann, you got to bring the fucking goods. And I think that's what Den of Thieves does, is that it meets at this intersection of high and low to where it's like, sure, I'm making Heat, but at the same time, I'm going to deliver an action movie that, like, the dude who's just going to 7-Eleven, getting a six-pack of PBR, a couple hot dogs, and then renting a movie at the Red Box to take home afterwards, this is going to entertain that guy, too. It's gonna connect with the true cinephiles who love Michael Mann, but also Joe Schmo, hot dog and six-pack guy, is going to take this home and be like, yo, Den of Thieves fucking shreds, dude.
It's what we've often talked about with, like, you know, quote-unquote rip-off movies, like horror films, where it's, oh, hey, we're just going to do Halloween, right? But the filmmaker sometimes couldn't help but, like, add their own personality to it.
Sure.
What I like about Den of Thieves is everything that's not Heat, you know, is like you have, I mean, I love the Heat stuff too, but it still has its really, really specific grungy vibe that you don't get with Heat. Heat has the dirtiness of L.A., but it's still very classy and clean in its own way. And this is like really B-movie, mean, racist assholes. Like Big Nick, kind of monstrous in his own way.
Kinda.
Yeah. You know, Coke snorting, drunk, bad father,
banging strippers.
Banging strippers.
Starting fights in hibachi joints.
Yeah, and it's funny because I actually like, it's a fun film to watch. Obviously, you and I have both seen Heat innumerable times, is to watch Gudegast's version of those scenes, because you have, you know, the very famous scene from Heat of Al Pacino and De Niro meeting at the diner. And instead of that, we get, it's, you're like, well, let's do it at hibachi. And it's this, like, dick-swinging argument between Paula Schreiber's crew and Nick and his guys. And it's just absolutely wonderful.
It has one of the best Big Nick O'Brienisms, too. Yeah, the food here sucks. We come here for the ass. You're like, dude! And he's literally looking right at their wives as he says it. And it's like, my friend, you've crossed like three lines here at once. Also, the staff can probably hear you.
Yep.
Like that cook who's just cutting up some chicken and some beef right now is like, yo, man, I'm fucking making like $12 an hour. What's up, bro?
Doing my best.
This shit is good.
But it's, you know, the action, I think, to your point, too, that you get with these films and also the Rick Roman Waugh films is like, the action delivers on a really like street level thing, and because the budgets are not as large as what you're getting with like these big CGI fest, is like it's all like real street level gunfire, and so it's like it's just better. You and I like that stuff more, you know. Like,
and it has nice little sturdy flourishes, like that drone shot over the traffic jam right before the shootout begins, and like the whole heist sequence. That's the thing, is that like this movie is Heat for like 80 minutes, but then like the last hour of this is just one long action set piece. Like that's where like the balancing act kind of comes into play, is that he's like, here's all your character shit. Here's all the cops and robbers, hunter and prey stuff that I'm borrowing from man. But then like the last hour, this is just the DTV action shit. Like it's just, we're at street level. We're going to have them break into the Fed. We're going to have Donnie, you know, who we haven't even mentioned yet, O'Shea Jackson Jr., you know, come in and basically be delivering Chinese food and, like, stealing, like, old money out of a box and stuff. And, like, he really gets into, like, you can tell that Gudegast loves the process of it. Like, he's as much into, like, Friedkin movies and Frankenheimer films, too, because he loves the process of a heist. He like, I bet you if you talk to Christian Gudegast, he would tell you he really likes Sorcerer, because it's like Sorcerer, for as awesome of an adventure movie as it is, it's also a process film.
The whole scene of blowing up the tree.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's just like, how we run into a roadblock, how do we get rid of it? How do we move these trucks from point A to point B? What's the planning? What happens if something goes wrong? What happens if the road crumbles? Like, this gets into the nitty gritty of the actual heist stuff. And like, you can tell that's where like Gudegast's brain kind of lives.
Yeah, you're 100% right. Cause, and not to jump ahead, but where you see where he goes with part two, you know what he was interested in.
Yeah.
Because like you're saying, like the Michael Mann Heat kind of cops and robbers stuff is like the first half of the movie. And when the heist takes over, it's also quite akin to like De Palma's Mission Impossible part
one. Oh, 100%.
Because it's like these little things of like, all right, here's what we have to do. Here's, okay, we can't get through this door because of this. So, and we know that the money's going to be here, and they torch it in this way. So we got to separate, we got to get in there between these two steps of the process. And you see how they do it. And he goes even bigger with that in the sequel. But it becomes like this really, really process-driven heist movie. Because, man, it's funny, especially with Heat, is like the heists aren't like these elaborate heists. Like, they're not Hollywood-y heists.
They're bank robbers.
They walk in, they go, give us the money, and then they walk out. And there's a shootout, amazing shootout. But this one is like, no, this is a like more movie.
Yeah.
High tech.
Man's into the realism, yes, of like the smash and grab.
Real, yeah.
Like jobbers, to where this is very much like the other thing that I was thinking about with this is that we constantly refer to it as a Heat ripoff. But what it really is, the first Den of Thieves, is that you ever go into like a bodega, particularly in like the Northeast or New York or whatever, and like they always have those like burned mixtapes that you can buy for like $3. Yeah. Den of Thieves is kind of like one of those mixtapes, only it's a mixtape of like the greatest action scenes from like the 90s, but put into this 2018 action programmer, because like you get the prom scene from like Bad Boys 2, you know, where Reggie comes to ask out or take Martin Lawrence's daughter out. You get the Kaiser Soze stuff from Usual Suspects.
Yeah. And the score.
Yeah, which is all Donnie's character, to where like there's the huge reveal at the end. You get a car chase. You get the Frankenheimer style shootouts, and you get some Ronin a lot in like Den of Thieves too.
Yeah,
but like you can just tell that Gudegast is like a student of the same type of movie that we really really like, and he's like, man, I've been trying to make this movie for over 10 years, like. I'm just going to put a little bit of everything that I like into it, because they might not let me make another one of these films again. So I'm going to stuff it full of all the influences that I really, really enjoy, and then also cast it within an inch of its life, because like O'Shea Jackson Jr. as Donnie is incredible. Yep. Like I always liked him, but like, let's face it. The biggest role I really knew him from up to this point was like Straight Out of Compton, where he plays his dad.
Yeah.
You know? And like he looks, there's no mistaking whose child O'Shea Jackson Jr.
The genes are strong.
Yeah, with Ice Cube, man. But then like, so I didn't really know that he kind of had this in him. And then he would go on to have a bit more of a career with like the King Kong movies and everything. And,
yeah.
But then Pablo Schreiber, who I always loved from The Wire and Orange is the New Black and stuff, like, he almost steals the entire movie.
He's amazing.
As Merriman, like, the head. He's basically the Neil McCauley of this Dirtbag Heat universe. Like, he's the one that Big Nick is taking on the whole time. And that's the other thing, is Gudegast is obviously very into military types and like, from working on London Has Fallen and then working on this too, is that because all of the guys who pull off this heist crew or make up this heist crew, they're all ex-military dudes.
Yeah.
And like you have him, 50 Cent is like legitimately really good.
Yeah.
The movie is the one, you know, as one of the crew members, and like just the way it's all kind of put together, and like you spend so much time with these dudes, it's like they don't seem like a great hang, but you understand the chemistry that they share. And also when the actual heists pop off and the violence pops off, that's the part that feels the most mannish, because like he gets into like the call signals, how they cover each other's back, deploying cover fire. Like, Gudegast really makes you feel like these guys have military training and would be able to take out a small army if it wasn't led by Big Nick O'Brien.
Yeah. What we were talking off mic, too. Like, this film really feels like an Ayer film to me, too.
Yeah, there's a lot of David Ayer in it.
Yeah, and then I think that he's pulling from I feel like Ayer kind of created that new feel with Training Day on.
Yeah, you can draw a straight line from Training Day to like Ayer's stuff, particularly like End of Watch and Street Kings.
Honestly, even Harsh Times.
Harsh Times, I think, a little ties bit. Into this, well, especially with the military stuff. Yep. Yeah. And then straight to Den of Thieves. I mean, the other movie that this shares a ton of DNA with, too, is a movie that I revisited for this, is 999.
Yeah.
You know, the John Hillcoat crime film that also has, like, the most stacked cast of all time with Casey Affleck, Chiwetel Ejiofor, Kate Winslet.
Woody
Harrelson, Aaron Paul, Gal Gadot. Like, the list goes on in that movie. And I did not like that film the first time I watched it in theaters. I went back and revisited it. I'm going to tell you 100%, I fucked up on that one, because that's just another down and dirty pulp programmer, the likes of which we just don't really get. And if you made that again today, it would be a Netflix series.
Yeah.
You know, it would probably be 6 hours long. You would get whole Woody episodes. You would get whole Casey Affleck backstory episodes. You would get more into Chiwetel Ejiofor, and you would definitely get way more Kate Winslet in it. But, like, man, that movie exists in that same dirtbag crime kind of microcosm that Den of Thieves comes from.
When we were also talking off mic about it, it got a lot of similarities with Wrath of Man.
Oh, yeah.
Which the Guy Ritchie film that you and I both really enjoyed with Statham.
Yeah.
Also has some...
The armored car robbery element of it.
Everything. Just the insane shootouts. I think that there's a real... There's a brutality and, like... Honestly, if he pulls anything from Man, it's like you think about his use of live ammunition on the making of Miami Vice.
Yeah.
Like that end shootout. It's very, like... The sound, the feel of the guns is very, like... It's not just... CGI,
the echo in particular.
It's just very tinny and really, it's just like you feel the violence and again, not to jump ahead, but you see what Gudegas has at his disposal when you get to part two as an action filmmaker.
Well, you just want to jump to part two?
Let's do it.
All right. About Den of Thieves 2, Pantera. Martin, first impression, what'd you think?
I liked it a lot. I thought, like, it really showed the versatility of, like, Gudegas as, like, an action filmmaker. Because it felt like if the first one is him really referencing a lot of, like, American, like, Michael Bay, Michael Mann, you know, kind of filmmakers, this is, like, Luc Besson's, like, EuropaCorps movies, you know, or, like you were saying earlier, Ronin. You know, these European-based heist movies, it takes on a whole different style.
See, where I came from with it is that, to me, it's like the Ocean's 12 of dirtbag crime cinema.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it felt like he was like, oh, shit, I finally got to make this movie. It was a modest hit. I have this great partnership with Gerard Butler. And Lionsgate is going to basically give me money to make another one. What if I kind of made like the arty movie that nobody's going to let me make? Because the thing to me is that like the crime and heist elements of this to where they're front and center really from like the first sequence in Den of Thieves, the heist stuff in Pantera is almost like an afterthought. Like you get the early where they're in Africa stealing the diamond and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, they move to fence it. Donnie does. And after that, like it's basically like an hour and a half without any action whatsoever.
Yeah.
It's Big Nick coming, you know, we're introduced to him in divorce court. He's lost everything. He's basically living out of his truck, and he's still obsessed with getting Donnie, who you know evaded him at the end of Den of Thieves, the original. And he, through some shenanigans, that it's the one part of the movie that, out of all of it, stretches the most credibility for me because, like, he's basically like, I'm a U.S. Marshal, but, like, I'm internationally deputized because I went on a manhunt one time in like South America, but now I guess that extends to France to where I can bring this guy in. But it's just one of those like just yada yada it. Like whatever, go with it.
Yeah.
Big Nick is in France. He's pursuing Donnie. He teams up with this international set of cops who are after, you know, these bandits. and we're off to the races, but it becomes about Big Nick going and teaming up with Donnie and being part of the heist this time and becoming part of this kind of international crew. And you just kind of hang out with them.
Yeah.
For an hour and a half in these awesome French locations in this coastal city and everything. And like, man, for me, this might have been a better Michael Mann impersonation than the first film, because it reminded me most of stuff like Miami Vice, to where like the majority of that movie, you're just hanging out with Colin Farrell and Jamie Foxx as they go from exotic location to exotic location undercover, making friends, getting themselves embedded in these crime syndicates. But like, there's not a ton of action. It's more, again, just about process. But the process is like making these human connections, making these relationships
and vibes,
and just all vibes. Yeah. And this is it, is that it's Big Nick vibing with this international crew and then plotting to take down basically the World Diamond Center
exchange
in
or
France,
yeah.
The World Diamond Exchange. But it's like dudes doing accents, you know, gorgeous locations, gorgeous women, drugs, alcohol, like, and again, just pure, like, and also like the ambient score of this movie. That's the most man part of this, is that it's almost meditative and even like existential at times, because like we talked about in the last segment, watching Butler kind of grow as a performer, he gets to like do the full on like Michael Mann brooding
and quiet,
staring at the horizon, wrestling with his conscience as he gets deeper and deeper. And we try to figure out what side of the law he's actually on the whole time. Like it's totally like, I saw this twice in 24 hours, and like, I'm not going to lie, it's crazy that in the first week of 2025, we're going to have a hardcore contender for my favorite movie of the year, because I'm going to watch this movie at least 10 times this year. Like, it's just, I already foresee when this comes out on streaming and I get a copy of it, or if I get a Blu-ray of it, it's just going to be a thing like Miami Vice, where I just put in my player and then just let roll in the background, because I just like hanging with it. Because then when you actually get to the heist set piece, that's kind of the big thing, it's almost entirely silent.
Yep.
Like it's done closer to like a Mission Impossible movie.
Yeah, again, like
a De Palma movie.
Yeah, De Palma, Mission Impossible 1 in particular.
Well, and the other movie it really made me think of was Femme Fatale.
Yeah.
And like just those international kind of chase movies that he would do where it's all espionage and intrigue and like...
And so Ronin.
Oh, yeah. A lot of Frankenheimer and Ronin. Not just Ronin, but also French Connection Part 2.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Popeye Doyle goes overseas to France and stuff. Like, it's pretty fucking cool, man. And it's Gutagast just being like, again, kind of like with the first one, I don't know if I'm ever going to get to make a movie like this again. So I'm going to make the best version of it, or at least the version that's in my head the most. And like, I could see how some people who might have loved the original might be disappointed with this, because it is so much more vibes focused instead of action focused. But like, I've only seen it twice, to where I've seen the original Den of Thieves upwards of like 10 times at this point. Like, but initial response, I might prefer this one, because I really dug it.
Yeah, I think I prefer it too. Because like you said, I didn't even think about it, but it's more Manny. It's very neon, just the colors, the nightlife, the experiential side of being like in this beautiful city and these beautiful places and with these beautiful people. And honestly, the camaraderie between O'Shea Jackson and Gerard is amazing.
Oh my God, they get to have a whole buddy movie.
Yeah, it's so like, because it starts out as like, hey, fuck you, man. But then like they have their heat scene of like talking about their dads and like why they are the way they are and shit. Like,
and
it's awesome.
The thing is, those that scene is amazingly acted on both of their parts. Like when, you know, O.J. Jackson Jr. Donnie talks about his dad getting shot right in front of him, and then Big Nick relays the idea that like his dad owned a liquor store and was shot in the leg and walked to work every day with that limp, and how that's what made him pick up a gun and the badge, because he just always wanted to catch those guys and never could. Like, it explains so much about these dudes, and like, it shouldn't work. Like, a scene like this with that much exposition and that much blatant referencing of, like, it's particularly, like, that feels more like the Heat diner scene than anything else.
Yeah.
But, like, these guys just click in a way. And, like, Gudegast is really just kind of tuned into a frequency that's both familiar but also 100% this movie's own. That's, like, it's really hard to do.
No, because I kept thinking, like, when we were watching it, I said, man, like, there hasn't been an action scene, to your point, in, like, an hour, but I'm fine.
Yeah, I don't care.
Because I'm, like, I'm locked in. I'm, like, really, like, I'm vibing with this movie. And then when it does get to the action, like, the heist is amazing. But then there's this ridiculously amazing car chase.
Oh, my God, with the machine gun
battle.
It's
just, like, holy fuck.
In the tunnel. And it's, like, it's almost, like, you have to wonder how much money Audi gave this production, because they're all just driving Audis and shooting the fuck out of each other.
Which is what they drive in fucking
in
Ronin, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
and like, and that whole tunnel shootout is incredible. But then also, like, it does the thing that Man does, and I won't say what song it is, but know how Man threads the needle of putting music in his movies that, again, it's total, like, vibes focused. But, like, I've never liked Moby outside of, like, listening to it in, like, a Jason Bourne movie or a Michael Mann movie. I don't like Audio Slave, but I love it when it needle drops in Collateral or Miami Vice.
Yeah.
Like, this shit shouldn't work, but for whatever reason, Michael Mann, just despite having possibly poor taste, he's able to really just find these songs,
the right song for
exactly
them.
For that moment. But like, Gudegast, I'm just gonna say it. He drops an M83 song at the end of this movie that should be corny and not work at all, but it makes you like, I couldn't believe I was getting wistful with a Big Nick at the end, and like. The other thing that this movie does, too, is that, like, and me being me, and I can only be me, is that all of the Eurocrime mafia boss stuff of dudes coming out of the hills and, like, little safe houses, because it's the Pantera Mafia who basically, Donnie makes the mistake of stealing a diamond from the Pantera Mafia, which is, like, more or less like the Sicilian mob.
Yeah.
You know, the real old school Italian dudes. They come out and they come after Donnie and Big Nick in the process. So they have to steal the diamond back and give it to the Pantera Mafia while also pulling off the diamond heist that they want to pull off. And so it just, again, it taps into that old school 70s and 80s Italian crime stuff that I love so much. And like, just these old dudes in the hills sipping cappuccino who will also have you decapitated at like a moment's notice if they want to.
Yeah.
Reading Italian newspapers and shit. And it's just like, this is so like a Jacob coded movie in so many different ways that, like, of course I went and saw it twice in 24 hours. I'm going to go see it again this week because, like, and I'll probably see it a couple more times while it's in theaters because, like, in the same way that we were talking about with, like, Law Abiding Citizen, is that, like, we have to recognize when we get something special delivered to us and something that, like, we don't normally receive, even at this high level of quality. Like, even if this was just a 3-star, pretty good, but parts of it didn't really work, I would probably still go see it again just because, like, this is a gift, man. Like, so few of these movies are released, and they're so far between anymore that we have to relish them when we actually get the opportunity.
Well, and you and I talked about this we're also, it's a really exciting time of the year for lovers of genre cinema.
Yeah.
Because it is the dumping ground for B movies, and they're not, they don't want to compete with Marvel. They don't want to compete with like the Thanksgiving. They don't want to compete with award season. They want to compete with like the Christmas movies or the Wickeds. But this is that time pretty much until what, March?
Well, and also you have Sundance going on. So yep. Like half of the big name titles are going to the festival. Like we're seeing Wolfman tomorrow night. Yep. So like, and then you have like Hard Eyes is next month.
Yeah, we got two Soderbergh films coming out.
Two Soderbergh movies.
Both Black written by Bag. David Koepp.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, we get Presents next week. Like, yeah, this is the prime time for like if you like genre cinema and don't have a whole lot else to do, guess what? You're in for a buffet, buddy.
Yep, and this is a good start to it.
Yeah, I mean, Den of Thieves 2, I was excited for this movie. I can't lie. Like, it would have taken a massive fuck up for me to walk out of it and be like, that was bad. I didn't like that. Like, I still probably would have stretched and be like, two and a half stars. You know, not bad. But, like, the fact that this is, like, a borderline masterpiece is fucking mind-blowing. I can't believe how good this movie looks, how good it sounds, and how I just wanted to basically live in it the entire time. I mean, like, Big Nick gets his Miami Vice mojito dance moment.
Yep.
But he's smoking pixie dust and taking shots of, like, weird Eastern European, like, liquor. And then he gets to love up on, like, the crime boss who's, like, hot as shit the entire time.
She's great, this too.
And, like, this movie just, like, it knows what it's doing. It knows what it's delivering. And, like, Gudegast, I think, is a really special filmmaker who's going to be with us for a long time.
Yeah, and, again, I think this episode has led us to him and also to Rick Roman Waugh. I think that Butler has got some really interesting collaborators. And looking at his future IMDb, he's doing a couple more with both of them.
Yeah.
Gudegast is doing a Statham movie next.
Yeah.
So
can't wait.
It's going to be great.
Yeah. And we were talking about dumping grounds too, is we get a working man from David Ayer. We basically get his next beekeeper.
Dude, what a time to be alive, man. Just more of this, please.
Yeah. I don't want, like, and the other thing too is that, like, for us, you know, we just sat through, and I'm saying this like it's a huge burden, don't get me wrong, but like, we just sat through stuff like The Brutalist and Nickel Boys and like all of the awards contenders, stuff that actually takes a massive amount of like intellectual engagement on your part.
Yeah.
And it's not homework per se, but like, you definitely are like, every time you're sitting down for a movie, particularly in December, you're like, okay, I need to turn my brain on.
Yeah.
Like, and that's the other thing that's great about the January and February kind of dumping grounds is that you're just like, it's like going to McDonald's after eating like filet mignon for a whole month, is that you're just like, man, just give me a couple double cheeseburgers, brother. That's all I want.
Yeah.
But the thing with Den of Thieves 2, this is real like Royale with cheese shit, man. Like, you're going there and you're like, I'm getting the best European version of this hamburger, and it's awesome.
Yeah, highly recommend for just like, and it took me a while to come to the, you know, I saw Den of Thieves just a couple weeks ago. Highly recommend that, and then you got to see two walls in the theater. I'm going to go again, I think, too. So
let's go together.
Let's go.
Brother, welcome to the club.
Glad to be here.
But what do we got next for a Martin?
We're going to do our best of 2024.
Yep.
And it was it was a good fucking year.
Great fucking year.
I'm going to have some trouble doing that. And then
I have a list of 20 movies on my phone I have to pick from. We have to whittle them down to 5 apiece.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, what a chore we have.
I know.
Oh, my God. But then after that, I think we're going to do some Luca Guadagnino to celebrate the duology of Challengers and Queer. A movie we haven't really gotten to yet and was absolutely one of my favorite films of last year.
It was real good.
And then after that, we got a whole slew of genre cinema coming up. Maybe some Charles Bronson.
Yep.
Maybe some Ozploitation, finally. Maybe some Valentine's Day slashers, since we got Hard Eyes coming up. I mean, we also have Wolfman, which we might see Wolfman tomorrow night and suddenly be inspired to do a Lee Whannell episode. But you know what? We don't know what it's going to be until you tune in next time to Secret Handshake.
See you next time.
Bye.